Search number 8735.
Dr. Saxton, tape 9.
Well, after withdrawal from the Ebro, and in spite of the knowledge that the international gates are being withdrawn, there was still a terrible lot of fighting going on, because the front line was now fluid, you might say, and a lot of international brigaders were rather lost in no man's land, or in land that might have belonged to one party or the other, but they didn't know which, and small groups were sort of fighting their way out, and some were even stuck the wrong side of the Ebro. So the whole position was very confused, and we retreated quite a way and set up another hospital further back, but I cannot remember where it was. People who were part of our unit sort of intercepted as they came along the road. It was all very confused, and we formed another little hospital there, or a group of medical workers more than a hospital. I don't think we could do very much in this sort of fluid situation. At any rate, we all knew that we were going home, and we could see that that we had no obvious place there anymore. In spite of that, some of the military units did reform, international units even, and sort of form a group of resistance here and there to the very rapid advance of the enemy. Nevertheless, from a medical point of view, we really did very little. And at that time, we were still in touch. The people who had been recruited through the medical Spanish Medicaid Committee with the Barcelona office, and through them, most of us were evacuated before the final parade. And I flew out from Barcelona airfield. I don't remember when exactly.
38.
Yes. So I flew to Perpignan, took the train home, as it were.
How did you feel about that, leaving before things were over?
Well, I felt pretty bad about going. I felt, you know, like the rats running out of the sinking ship, something like that. Our morale was bad. My morale was bad. I can't speak for other people. And all the time we'd sort of, even up to the last moment almost, we felt there was a chance that we could still come out victorious. I couldn't see it. All the time I felt, how can the French government, it was a Blum government, wasn't it? It was a government of United Front, they didn't call it that, but something like this, United Left sort of government. How could they permit another fascist government? They got Hitler on one side of them. They got Mussolini close by. How could they let another fascist government be established on their other flank? I didn't think they could do it from, you know, just from the point of view of military point of view, looking to the future at all, but that wasn't the case. The French government was under tremendous pressure from Neville Chamberlain's British government, actually, because they had an alliance of sorts, which meant that if France were to be attacked by Germany, then we would come to the aid of France. But Neville Chamberlain, I believe, threatened the French that if he got involved in the war because of Spain, this would be abrogated. And so the French government was very much under British pressure not to do anything obvious in the way of helping the Republican government. The Republican government was, up to the last minute, really fighting. And indeed, Mussolini, the Italian fascist government, who was fighting on the side, were financially in such difficulties that they were delighted to, so I'm told, to receive Republican money, because Republicans had the Bank of Spain at their disposal, and gold, in fact. And they bought quite a considerable quantity of machine guns and things like that from the Italians right towards the very end. The Italians would be shot with them. Terrible the way these things work out. But up to the very end, the Republican government was doing what it could, but it was no good in the face of the really overwhelming support which the Franco was getting from the Germans and Italians. And, of course, the weakness of the military leadership in Madrid at the time.
Was that very obvious, their superiority regarding weapons and aircraft?
Did
you know, with your own eyes?
Just for the very short time around the battle for Madrid, the red planes, what do they call them now? Flies, they're called Moscas, I think. were able to control the air over Madrid. And one or two battles, they did catch the large bodies of enemies out in the open with the Red Air Force, as it might be, the Republican Air Force. Then one of the battles where the Italians really had a very bad time, when they had enormous numbers of troops and artillery and tanks out in the open, and they were simply mopped up by by the Republican Air Force. They had a very nasty defeat there. But apart from those two occasions, the build-up of the Italian and German Air Force was far, far beyond anything that the Republicans could achieve. They were training all the time, new airmen, young men were training to be pilots, but they didn't get anywhere, they weren't enough. And, of course, the Germans had their greatest victory, as you may imagine, over this little town in the north, in Biscaya. What is their famous place? Guernica. It was razed to the ground by the Condor planes.
Did you hear about that while you were in Spain?
Oh, yes.
What sort of effect did that have on morale?
Well, it's a bit morale. Perhaps it even improved it, because it made people so angry.
Did it? Is that the reaction to it?
Yes. Oh, it's a terrible thing. Of course, you know. And Picasso's picture of it later was well known to so many people, but this is later. Yes. Well, so we returned to England, and after a while, of course, we formed the Association of Veterans and so on, which still exists today.
When you got back to Britain, what sort of reception did you receive?
Well, I personally, you see, we came back in drips and drabs with the medical people who were sent out and were brought back with the help of the Spanish Medical Committee. So we didn't have much of a reception as a medical group. But, of course, the soldiers of the International Guards who came back had a magnificent reception. I don't know which terminals they arrived at. Was it Victoria or somewhere? At any rate, there were tremendous crowds came out to greet them. They really pulled themselves together and showed a lot of spirit and marched and sang and did this all in the station. It was a really good reception. But then, of course, we all gradually dispersed to our various homes and or places of origin or wherever.
How interested were the public in what you had experienced? When you came back, your circle of acquaintanceships and friends, were they very interested in what had happened in Spain, and did they realise the significance of it, do you think?
Very hard to say, isn't it? I think it depends how politically conscious they were to start with. Some of them developed during that time with the experience of Spain itself, but no, I would say that those who were ignorant of these things and whose interests didn't take them in political directions, the majority of them, although they expressed admiration for brave people and this sort of thing, one of my sort of sponsors, almost, not really a sponsor, but someone who supported me a lot during my time there, was an old lady who lived in the same nursing home as my grandmother. A very intelligent woman who kept writing me letters, who collected money to buy me a typewriter which I took to Spain with me. I collected it, I think, on my 6 weeks holiday or something, I forget. Anyway, she got me this typewriter, and she used to send me foodstuffs and presents and letters, and then from the letters I wrote to her, she'd write articles for the press, that's right, and the money she got for any articles she wrote, because she was a journalist and herself had been a journalist, then she put this money towards buying the typewriter, which I had. So I must have got that when I came on leave. But you see, all the time she kept talking about six of one and half dozen of the other, and this annoyed me so. And the people remained like that. Six of one and half dozen of the other. They're all a lot of, I don't know what, they didn't use the word terrorist in those days, but there's a sort of attitude that people who go to excess, people, they're not nice, quiet, middle of the road people. That was the sort of attitude.
Did you ever suffer victimisation?
Not really, no. A lot of those who came back did, especially the Americans. The Lincoln Battalion, Abraham Lincoln Battalion, Lincoln for short, when they went back to America, and soon after that was the era of McCarthyism, right? Oh, they were just plum targets for McCarthyism. They had a terrible time. They persecuted and prosecuted and lost their jobs and considered as pariahs for many, many years. Even now, well, things are easier a little bit now. And in any case, most of them are dead by now, so what of it? But yes, they had a very tough time. Everyone had a tough time, maybe the British less than most. British toleration, what? Yes, but still, people did lose their jobs in England too. I didn't have a job to lose anyway.
Did you find it difficult to get a job though?
No, not really. Not seriously. Because after all, when I came back I hadn't got a job. What job could I do? A locum in medical practice is the sort of jobs I got to start with. I could just get by earning a bit, a few weeks at a time, as a locum. And the locums were arranged by my own, to start with, you know, through my own hospital, but they weren't really prejudiced against me. I mean, they knew about me. But I wouldn't have said they were gross prejudiced, not to that extent, at any rate. Then I applied for jobs. I found out that another doctor who had been at the said, not Sherlock, Jerry Sherlock. I think you were one of those who was never quite on our side, really. Like Cochrane, Archie Cochrane. He's a good guy. I still like him. He's a nice fellow. But he was never quite with us, not altogether. He's one of those who sits in judgment above other people. He doesn't join anyone. And, you know. And Archie Cochrane was one of those. And I remember Krem, who originated in Latvia, and so his English, just the tiniest bit odd, because he's born English. You know how English is a very difficult language. And He said, Archie has become hostile. The word wouldn't use, you know. He's hostile. like an Indian friend of mine used the word costly, you know. Now, we don't say, oh, that's very costly. Perfectly good English to say something in a shop is very costly, but would use the word. It's just that slight foreigner can never quite make it, it seems. Anyway, so some people drifted away from us a bit after the war and became hostile, but not many. And the hostilities ebbed away with time. So few of us who remain are friendly, on the whole. I don't know what happened to Jerry Shalor. Oh, I was saying, Jerry Shalor got a job in air raid precautions because of his experience in Spain. I thought, oh, why can't I do the same? I mean, I've got no means of earning a living regularly except doing these locums. This didn't seem right. I was a qualified doctor, and although I'd forgotten nearly all I knew through these years, 2 years in Spain, I still knew enough, and what's more, I was still going to learn it again, which I did. And then I saw advertised in the paper, having thought of Sherlock, I saw advertised, ARP medical officer, assistant medical officer, wanted in Brighton. So I applied and got the job. And so, only 6 weeks, I think, before the Second World War started, I took up my position as assistant medical officer of health for civil defence in Brighton. And there I was able to use some of my experiences in Spain.
How important do you think it was, your experience in Spain, for your subsequent life? You know, what sort of lessons did you learn there?
It was terribly important to me at an emotional level. And to all of us, I'm sure. It engraves things so deeply on us that we can't, even if we wanted to, get rid of them. And it determined what sort of friends I made, what sort of people I rejected as friends, and what I did with my life. Into the big driving force. But how did it affect my medical career? Is that what you mean?
Well, all aspects, really. What you have just said is very interesting.
Well,
I
you
think.
See, the war started, the Second World War, within quite a short time of my coming home. And I was, by that time, established as ARP medical officer, whatever, in Brighton. And from there I went into the British Army. And before going to the British Army, I realised that, well, the thing I knew most about, in a sense, in the military sense, was blood transfusion. Not that I really was that fast a skill, but I had experience. And I sort of vaguely thinking about this and asking one or two people whether it, you know, I could get working in the blood transfusion business in the army, even when I went to the army, which I was expecting to go in the army. I couldn't remain forever doing ARP work in Brighton. And so I asked, and I was told, now, once you have been called up, it's insubordination to make any such request to be transferred to a particular place or whatever it is, grouping of work in the army. It's insubordination. So, the sensible thing is to make inquiries while you're still a civilian. So, I did, and I wrote to the Army Transfusion Service headquarters in Bristol under Colonel Whitby at that time, and tell him my experiences as in blood transfusion, saying, that I rather hoped I would be able to utilise my experience in the British Army when I was called up, as I was expecting to be called up sometime in the next few months. And lo and behold, that's where I was sent. And as far as the Army is concerned, I was in the Army Transfusion Service for the whole war, and I took a unit in a very similar vehicle to the one I had in Stain to Burma, to Arakan. We had a couple of field units there. And later I was promoted to an advanced base unit in Calcutta. But I had some quite interesting, valuable experiences in Burma, which I think, you know, were facilitated by my previous experience in Spain. And I think a lot of our ex-Spanish doctors did that. I mean, on all sorts of different fronts our people performed, and some of them got their DSOs and I was mentioned in dispatches and this sort of thing, you know. I mean, I think the British Army benefited from our experiences. So it determined that part of my life, the military side at any rate. Subsequently, well, I think it determined my personal life, the people I mixed with, the people I could tolerate more than the ones. You know, I don't think I'm an intolerant person, really, but I think I've got, to a certain extent, blinkers. Because if you're going for some objective, there are side effects which you wouldn't necessarily like. You know, I recognise that in myself.
This organisation, this group you belong to, you were saying you have meetings each year.
Oh, yes.
Yes, could you tell me something about that?
The, yes, International Brigade Association, then. The veterans of the International Brigades, then, have an association. It is really a social rather than a political body. Efforts were made by various people at different times to politicise it, so to speak, and to use it to assist in political events, perhaps elections or heaven knows what, but political activities, one kind or another. But that has always been firmly resisted by the leadership in the association. I'm not part of the leadership. I mean, I'm just a member. But when, for instance, we've met internationally sometimes, and people have wanted to pass resolutions and send messages to governments and so on, that has always been very much resisted by and obstructed and prevented, in fact, as far as the British Association is concerned. So we are really a social gathering of veterans who get together and pat each other on the back and drink each other's health and talk about the old days and discuss and hear about those who've died and that sort of thing. But in a way, of course, in a subtle sort of way, we do encourage each other by telling each other what we've been doing and what we're up to now, and perhaps encouraging each other to participate in some minor activities, not activities in fact that the association itself takes any official position in, but which individuals on their own can do. I mean, for instance, there's some big CND rally and you meet a friend and say, oh, are you going to that? And shall we arrange to meet afterwards? Or what about coming along to help in some other activity as individuals? But the association has always studiously refrained from being itself political. In the early days, it was very much concerned with saving the lives of people who had been international brigaders and who had been arrested thereafter and imprisoned, and many leading international brigaders were saved by activities of that type. But that's not quite the same as political work at home. We haven't really taken any part in home politics. But
and would it still be a fairly left organisation, though, do you think? Would most of the members be communist or socialist?
As individuals, yes. it isn't a left-wing organisation because it's limited to people on different grounds altogether, people who happen to have been in Spain. But because most of those people were left-wingers, of course it's an organisation of left-wingers, but not a left-wing organisation because it doesn't undertake any political activity. Its membership is entirely of veterans of the Spanish Civil War and their families, if you like. I mean, the spouses come along, the children too, sometimes now, but it's literally, and because of only of age, a dying organisation. And I mean, who could that be who's under 60? Very few. And this last minute died. I mean, there were perhaps about 2,000 of us went from Great Britain, and 533 was the count I heard of people who actually died of those 2,000. So it's a quarter died, and beyond that about 1,000 were wounded quite seriously. So there's a tremendous mortality, and damaged people in vast numbers who came back and who disabled, and only a minority came out alive and perfectly fit. I was one of the lucky ones. But then, don't you see, doctors are cosseted a bit, aren't they? You know, I mean, because they have a value as for treating the wounded, they're cosseted from themselves being wounded. They're kept a little bit behind the actual fighting line. Not too far behind, because we always aimed at early treatment. That's why we had these mobile surgical units that get right near the front.
Yes, I was thinking of your little mobile unit, and it seemed you were far from cosseted at times.
Yes, that. And the surgeons, you see, with their autoschirrs, they call them, automobiles with surgical setups in them, they could move quite quickly with a complete surgical unit, all the equipment for it, at any rate, right up to any building fairly near the front. And the Second World War, of course, it learned a lot from that sort of thing too. Getting the patient quickly, before he'd lost a lot of blood, before his wounds got too contaminated, before he was grossly shocked, and starting the treatment, stopping further deterioration in severe wounding. This was learned from Spain. Oh, well, amongst other places maybe, but it was certainly learned from Spain.
Well, Dr. Staxon, thank you very much indeed for sharing your experiences with us.
Yes. Well, I'm glad to do it, really. It's a tremendous emotional experience for me.